I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Opposing opinions in politics is nothing new, but as the U.S. revs up for another presidential election, the harshness of that divide will be taking center stage. On one side is President Obama, who in his State of the Union speech spoke of government's ability to restore the American promise of fairness. On the other side, his Republican rivals, who feel that government should have a more limited role. Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential scholar Doris Kearns Goodwin has documented the presidential courses of JFK, Lincoln, LBJ, and FDR. Today, Goodwin talks with us about U.S. partisan politics and how the acrimony can sometimes be tamed by uncommon alliances. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. I'm Steve Kraske. Our politics today? Yep, pretty bad. It's highly partisan, angry, uncooperative. A lot of folks say it's an out-and-out mess. But get this, it's been worse. When? Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin is with us today to shed some light on that and to talk about a group of men who, in her words, she's had long-term relationships with. Nothing salacious here. I'm talking about men such as FDR, JFK, and LBJ, who Kearns Goodwin has written books about, as well as a guy named Lincoln, whose presidency was the focal point of her critically acclaimed book, 2005's Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Doris Kearns Goodwin appears regularly on NBC, MSNBC, and Meet the Press, and she was last on this program in 2006, which means it's been far too long. She joins us this morning from her home in Concord, Massachusetts. And Doris, welcome back. So good to have
you
again.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, let's begin with the news of the day, Doris, which is Mitt Romney's big win in the Florida primary last night. You know, a lot of folks are wondering if the nomination race is really over now. What do you think?
Well, I suppose if you were betting, you would think that it is. but it sounds like Mr. Gingrich just wants to keep it going somewhat longer.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wants to, you know, and if there's enough money for him to go past February, his hope lay, I suppose, in those southern states, which will be in March. But that's going to be a long time away. And there's no question the momentum has been broken, I think, for him.
Did he come off as something of a sore loser last night because he didn't congratulate Mitt Romney on his big win last night? He really sort of sidestepped the whole thing. What was your take on it?
Yeah, I think there are certain kind of courtesies that all of the people in politics usually observe. I mean, presidents who lose call the people who have beaten them the next time around, and I was surprised at that. It takes nothing away from the idea that you're going to keep going on forward if you congratulate them on the win. The win is a fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was probably a mistake on his part.
What did you make of Governor Romney's speech last night?
Well, you know, clearly he was trying to move past already the, you know, sort of the anger of the primary debates by saying, you know, don't worry about us. Yes, it's been angry, but now we're better prepared.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make something positive out of what everybody has been arguing, which is that it's probably hurt the Republican brand to have that kind of intense personal argument going. I mean, we've seen it before. Obviously, when Hillary and Obama were running against each other, there were a couple debates where you could feel a certain dislike. But for the most part, out of their 24 debates, they were much more civil than these have recently been.
Hmm.
So I think he was attempting to look to the future and assure people that if he is the nominee, which he thinks he will be, that this will be forgotten in people's memories.
You know, there are groups out there that calculate these things and have already determined that the Florida presidential primary was the most negative in American history. It was that bad.
Yeah, you know, usually you can imagine there are ads, a few ads that are bad. I mean, you remember that South Carolina ad that went against John McCain from the Bush camp,
yes,
claiming that he had fathered a child out,
yes,
of wedlock who was black, and some of the stuff that Atwater did against Dukakis. But I think what may have happened in the last 10 days before this Florida campaign, it was just relentless. And that's partly because of the amount of money that's being spent now, just enormous amounts of money. So you're seeing that negativity over and over again, and it reaches a saturation point where probably that study is correct, that it was more negative than before. Individual ads may have been negative in the past, but they just didn't keep going on and on and on like these two did.
We're visiting with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Doris, can you even imagine a scenario in which Newt Gingrich would be elected president?
I was beginning to imagine it, to be honest, and I never thought I would have before, you know, this trouncing, because it did seem that he had caught a wave of conservatives, and there is a split in that Republican Party. And so I had begun to imagine that if perhaps Santorum went over to his side, you know, if Paul just continued going along at his level, you could see even from the vote counts last night that if there were no Paul and there were no Santorum, and if both those groups had gone with Gingrich, which is not necessarily clearly so, that he would have been close or even beaten Romney. So the split in the Republican Party still remains open for somebody to exploit on the conservative side, but I'm just not sure that Gingrich may have hurt his own ability to do that in the way he conducted the campaign.
You know, there's a lot of speculation this morning. Governor Romney's on his way to Minnesota, I think, as we speak, and some speculation that Michelle Bachmann, who was a candidate until she dropped out a few weeks ago, might be endorsing Mitt Romney today, which would begin to help with some of those voters you just were talking about, Doris.
No question. I think that would be a helpful thing for him because, interestingly, when Gingrich got Rick Perry on his side and then Herman Cain, you know, it seemed like he was lining them up. I mean, the moment it seemed to me that Gingrich's campaign was going to have a huge hurdle to get over was when Senator Dole put out an amazing statement where he said,
We'll try and get Doris Kearns going back on the air here in just a moment. I think we've lost her. Doris, are you there? Yeah, we'll get her back here in just a moment. We're visiting with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner. You might know her best from her 2005 book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. And sometimes calls just disappear, and we hope to get her back here in just a moment. If you want to join our conversation here with your questions about presidential history, how this Republican presidential race compares to others in recent years, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org. Doris, you didn't hang up on me, did you?
No, I certainly didn't hang up on you. All of a sudden, you were gone. And what I was saying was that it seemed to me one of the turning points was when the establishment truly went against Gingrich, and that statement that Senator Dole made was extraordinary, that this is our last stand.
Yes.
You know, otherwise there could be disaster in the election to come. So if some of these conservatives now can sign up with Romney, I think that does help him absolutely to cross that bridge of the divided party.
You know, you mentioned Bob Dole, and obviously he's from our neck of the woods here. And, you know, it's amazing to me now, Doris, I want to guess he's 86 now, but he is still having an impact even at this point in his life, which is just amazing to me.
Oh, well, I tell you, the older I get, the gladder I am to hear that people, as they get older, are still listened to. I mean, he has a dignified past. He was a leader of the Republican Party. And I think those words that he was willing to say at this time really did carry weight.
You made a good point on Meet the Press last Sunday in talking about ways in which, you know, other presidents have managed to connect with people. And you were talking about Mitt Romney and how he's struggling in that category. How did other presidents, even those who were fairly well off, Doris, you know, find a way to relate to, you know, everyday Americans?
Well, I think there's two things. One is it's a temperamental quality. I mean, there are some people in public life that just naturally enjoy being with people, can reach out to them, can understand what they're thinking and feeling. I mean, obviously, Clinton was a master at that. But so, too, was Teddy Roosevelt. So, too, was FDR. So, too, was JFK in a lot of ways. And, you know, what I've thought about is in each of those cases, adversity had been an experience that those three presidents had shared. And it made them a more understanding person. I mean, they'd all come from privileged lives.
Mm-hmm.
But in Teddy Roosevelt's case, when he went west after his wife and his mother had died on the same day, he was playing around with cowboys. He was on a ranch. He was doing the hard work of the roundup. He saw a different slice of life than his normal privileged life would have given him access to. So, too, when FDR got his polio and he went down to Warm Springs and set up that center that all manner of people could come to, he understood other people to whom difficulties had also happened. And JFK had been in the war. War is one of those things when you're a soldier in combat where you learn, really, other people's ways of thinking. So it's not the wealth that separates you as much as life experiences and temperament, I think.
But, you know, President Obama is said to struggle with this aspect of the presidency, this idea of connecting with people. And he was a community organizer, famously, and sort of worked with regular folks for quite a while. Why has he struggled so much, do you think, to sort of relate to everyday folks?
You know, it's a mystery to me, to be honest, because, I mean, I've gotten to know him, and I think of him as an extremely warm, very approachable, very connective kind of person. And yet, obviously, other people have experienced this sense of some distancing. And I don't know. I mean, during the campaign itself, I don't think there was that sense of distancing, except for a few comments he made, remember, about people clinging to their guns, which seemed to be a sociological thing he was thinking about that sounded like disconnected from people who were having struggles in life. But he's certainly connected on the campaign trail, and it makes you wonder whether it's partly the White House itself that becomes a certain kind of bubble. And maybe as he gets out now more on the campaign trail, he seems more at ease in the last shots we've seen of him, singing and smiling. He's got a great smile when it comes out, and maybe he just needs that energy that comes from being with people as opposed to speaking in front of a teleprompter.
So handicap, then, the Obama-Romney race for us, Doris. I mean, where do you think we go here? How close might this race be?
Well, given the division in the country, I mean, it's probably inevitable that it's going to be close. All the races in these last years, you know, have been pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And so you probably have to imagine that this one is going to be that way as well. I mean, I think that what President Obama has done through his State of the Union message is to give himself a very strong message to go to the country with, because people are feeling that sense of the inequality, the gap between the rich and the poor, the fact that mobility in our country, which is really a mark of who we are, is not what it used to be. I remember seeing a study some weeks ago, that said we have less mobility now if you're born in a lower class to get to the next class up than people in Europe do, and that was the mark of who we were. And I think that's a really strong argument for him to take. And given the, you know, the Occupy Wall Street, given Romney's extraordinary, you know, Cayman Islands and money in various places, it might be an easy argument for him to really reach through to that middle class.
You know, a lot of folks, I guess me included, think that this race is going to be awfully nasty. I mean, Obama can't run on hope anymore. Romney has to go after the president. That's really a prescription for some pretty tough language, I would think.
I'm afraid you're probably right, and especially the super PACs now with the money they have, so the candidates can presumably claim they're distancing themselves from this nasty language. And it's all to the bad, I mean, because it doesn't allow the country to get mobilized. I mean, what we really need, it seems to me, in this election is a fundamental debate on the role of the government. You've got two very different points of view between the Republican conservatives and Obama. And if they were really willing to just duke it out on that, what should government do? What's its relationship to private enterprise? How do you meld the two together without constricting private enterprise and yet allow government to do for the country what it needs to do? That would be an uplifting thing. We need it in order to break through. And even if one of those people wins by a lot, even if it's not the person you want, maybe then they'd get the majority. They can get their chance to get their attitudes through. But otherwise, if we don't argue on that and we argue on personal attacks, we're going to get nowhere.
The acclaimed presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. She'll be the guest speaker at the William Jewell College's Achievement Day on March 1st at Kansas City's Westin Crown Center. Visit our website, kcur.org, for more information on how to go see Doris Kearns Goodwin when she's in town on March 1st. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate. At kcur.org. Let's go to some phone calls here. Dan from Lawrence. Dan, you're on with Doris Kearns Goodwin. Good morning.
Good morning. It's just, in my opinion, having watched a lot of the debates and the coverage of the run so far. I feel that Newt Gingrich is somewhat at a disadvantage, if only because he's not really given a fair shake, in relation to his chance of winning. I feel he's kind of viewed as a long shot from the start. So despite his good performances in the debate, which I think is hard to argue that he's done poorly in any of the debates, I feel that he's not necessarily being helped by the media, but I wouldn't go so far as to say necessarily hurt. But I feel that Mitt Romney, his eventuality of being the candidate is almost assured now in a lot of presentations.
Doris, do you think that the speaker has gotten a fair shake?
Well, I think, you know, he lived by, as somebody said, he lived by those debates and he died by those debates. You know, he did get a fair shake for a while when he was able to best Romney. He's a very intelligent man. And, you know, his responses in those early debates were really pretty good, and they made an audience follow him. I think the fact that a lot of his colleagues didn't feel comfortable with him becoming the presidential candidate, those who had known him well, that's not the media. They were reporting what those people said. So I think he had his chance. I mean, I think the thing that I don't know, not being in Florida, but it does seem like the super PAC negative ads really are what undid that extraordinary momentum from South Carolina to Florida, plus that he did not do well in those two debates right before it. It was weird. I mean, at one point he said the problem was that there was no response allowed by Brian Williams, and then the next debate he said they destroyed his rhythm.
Right,
so
right.
That he can't really have it both ways. But I suppose in the end, I mean, I think he's a really smart man. He's probably got great ideas. I've met him a couple of times. I like him, actually. But I think people began to worry, and the media was reflecting that worry about his temperament, whether he had the temperament to really become president, much less win.
You know, Tim from Platte Woods writes us this, Doris: has there been any other presidential candidate like Newt Gingrich who has felt it necessary to vindicate their long-term aspirations to be president by causing disarray in their own party?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I immediately know the answer. I mean, I think, obviously, you know, the only way you see this disarray in the party is ever since the primaries became so important. Because before that, you could go to a convention and the big guys would decide who was going to be the nominee, and all the internal stuff you wouldn't hear as much about. And even in the 60s, we only had a few primaries. Now they've multiplied to this point. So, you know, I suppose, you know, Pat Buchanan at one point during that race with Bush,
Yeah. There
was a lot of stuff that went on then. But I think this one has had more intensity than I can remember, but I might be forgetting something.
You know, how likely is it that this country could wind up electing, you know, say a Democratic president and then two Republican houses of Congress? Does that happen very often?
Not very often. I mean, it could happen. I mean, especially given how close everything is right now,
mm-hmm.
I think it's possible to happen. Although I think, you know, the night when we had the 2010 midterm elections, that was a certain sense in which you get a wave when people are upset with things happening, and it can be expressed more towards the Congress than it is towards a particular person. When you get to the presidential election, I think this is what I would suggest that President Obama should do. He should spend that campaign going out like Harry Truman did and really arguing in congressional districts for Democratic congressmen and senators. That's what Truman did on his whistle-stop tour. Then you can bring along your party with you. If he doesn't do that, you know, but people are upset with both parties. They right now say they don't want either of their candidates, not the presidential, but the congressional candidates back in there by huge margins. And it means it's really up for grabs as to which side is going to win.
Yeah, yeah. Back to some phone calls here. Paul from Overland Park. Paul, good morning.
Hi. I wanted to ask Ms. Goodman, what, if any, Romney's Mormonism, what effect that had on his election in Massachusetts to governorship? I know the question's come up in the recent past about whether it would affect his running for president. So I just wanted to know what happened in Massachusetts, if anything, vis-a-vis his Mormonism.
Doris?
No, I think it's actually a very positive sign that before this presidential election happened, there were polls that seemed to suggest that there were a significant significant number of people who would not vote for Mr. Romney because he was a Mormon. And that seems to have been, to some extent, diminished by that victory in Florida and here in Massachusetts as well. You know, it probably came up a little bit in the early parts of the debate, but very, very slightly. And he obviously became a governor and served as governor, and the Mormonism was not a large part of who he was. And I think that's all to the good. I mean, it would have hoped that when JFK was willing to go to Houston and talk about the fact that he hoped that his day of becoming president had not been undone from the day he was baptized, that the same thing would be true for Romney. The fact that he was born into a Mormon family, practices that religion, should have nothing to do with whether or not one decides that he's a good president or not.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. We'll talk partisanship, presidents, and baseball. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday with National Catholic Reporter writer Tom Roberts, you'll find it and all of our older broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look at preserving some historic buildings in Kansas City and building a new one on the lawn of the Nelson Atkins. That and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're visiting with the preeminent presidential historian, Doris Kearns Goodwin. She joins us from her home in Concord, Massachusetts. And Doris, you know, as bad as things are now when it comes to relations between Democrats and Republicans in Congress, you've said they've actually been worse at another point in history. When was that?
Well, I mean, clearly, if you look at the period in the 1850s, when senators were able to carry revolvers on the floor and pointed them at one another, and when one senator from Massachusetts was hit on the head with a cane by a Southern congressman,
almost
and hurt
killed
so
too.
Badly,
yeah.
Senator Sumner, that he was out of commission for a couple years. But, you know, but even saying that, I do think that in the last 30, 40 years, things have deteriorated. And I think part of the reason is that it used to be, at least like in LBJ's time and even JFK's, that senators and congressmen would stay in Washington on the weekends. They wouldn't go home. They didn't have to raise these extraordinary amount of funds. And they formed friendships across party lines. They'd play poker together. They'd drink together. And that allowed things like Everett Dirksen to be able to help LBJ to get the Voting Rights Act passed. In 1965, they had a long-term friendship. That's happened less now. And now you've got the way districts are now made, that people don't have to reach across the party lines, really, or even within their party reach across a segment. You've got the television people that probably like to have point-counterpoint, so they'd rather have the people on that can argue against one another. All these things, I think, have come together to make for less a camaraderie in that branch, in those two branches of government, which is really a trouble in a democratic system.
I was going to say, what's the long-term potential problem here? What might happen if this continues for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think what happens is that, you know, in a country that is a democracy, it depends upon the electorate having discussions that then inform the politicians, and the politicians listen to, and they get mobilized by it. And that disconnect that we're feeling right now, it's going to mean that fewer people who have quality are going to want to go into public life. Probably not as much fun now as it used to be 30 years ago. I mean, think about what it must have been like when you knew you had passed a piece of legislation, a voting rights, a civil rights bill that would make the history books look great, and you were part of it. And now to be down there knowing that very little is getting done, that you're looked upon with disgrace by most people in the country, I worry that it's going to affect the quality of people willing to go into public life, and then add to that the public exposure that the news media now puts on people's private lives. Will they be willing to sacrifice that, which wasn't sacrificable before, if such a word is really there?
Again, Doris Kearns Goodwin is the guest speaker at William Jewell College's Achievement Day on March 1st at Kansas City's Westin Crown Center Hotel. Visit our website at kcur.org for more information on that. Just go to programs and you'll find Up to Date there, and you can get more information on Doris's visit here. Back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Our email address again, uptodate@kcur.org. Harry from Leawood. Harry, you're on with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Well, thank you. I'd like to have Mrs. Goodwin's opinion on the amount of racism I'm noticing in this Republican primary. You know, statements such as Gingrich implying that blacks are the food stamp recipients and that Barack Obama is the food stamp president and so forth. It seems to be much more, it has been suppressed, I imagine, in the past. It seems to be much more prevalent now. Is this your opinion?
Well, surely that comment was meant to suggest some division, I think, of black and white. And it was factually not even true anyway, as it turned out. You know, and the fact is that the recession just put more people on food stamps than had been on before. But I don't think the numbers of blacks and whites on them were as he suggested. There's obviously a subtle racism intended, I suppose, or an appeal to a certain segment in those kind of comments. The one hopeful thing, I think, in the country, again, is that when those comments are made, they do get shot down and people do remark on them. And it might have been 50, 100 years ago that wouldn't have ever happened. So that's something positive to look forward to, I think.
Harry, thank you for the call. Let's go to Mike from Kearney. Mike, good morning.
Hi. My question is about electability. Several times the candidates have said, I'm the one who can beat the president, I'm the most electable one. And I wonder what kind of standard that is for electing a leader as opposed to the ability to unite or inspire or lead the Congress and the country to actually get real things done.
Wow, that's a really good question. And I must say I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I think in the context of this election, the reason it's being said by those various candidates is because they know they're up against the sitting president, and that's an extra hill to have mm-hmm. to climb. So they're saying, I'm the one that's electable. But you're right, if they don't give the reasons why they're electable underneath it, because I can do this, or I can do this, or I can unite, or I have these ideas, then it's simply a pure political statement that they're making. And that is what they tend to talk about. And, in fact, all the voters get asked that, who's the most electable? And then that seems like a really important standard to judge these guys by.
Hmm. Well, let's turn to your specialty, which is history, and talk about the presidents themselves. I wanted to get a sense if you think whether the historical standing of particularly the modern era presidents is improving, staying the same, or falling. Let's start with FDR, whom you've written so much about. Going up, going down, where is he these days, Doris?
Oh, I think he's probably always been in good shape, but maybe even better in recent years. I mean, one of the good things that happened when the FDR Memorial was created in Washington, there was a lot of controversy about that memorial for years because Republicans were not feeling comfortable with it. They got absolutely behind the memorial eventually. And I think the more we came away from an understanding of his leadership in World War II and what was done to make those Allied forces beat the Axis powers, the more he stands up as one of the great presidents.
How about our Harry Truman?
Harry Truman's had a great renaissance.
Yes.
I mean, when he left office and he was, you know, not very well liked by the country at the time, the public opinion polls were down, and yet he had done things that stood the test of time. Aid to Greece and Turkey, the Marshall Plan, recognition of Israel, his whole foreign policy, desegregation of the armed forces. And it shows that eventually historians and the public catch up with what a president has actually accomplished. And in Harry Truman's case, I think it's great.
How about our other president from out here, Ike, Dwight David Eisenhower?
Well, you know, in a certain sense, I think his stock has gone up.
I think so, too, yeah.
Because, after the wars in Vietnam and continuing wars now in Afghanistan and Iraq, one looks back on that era of the 50s and the fact that he could proudly say, you know, that once Korea was over, that he had not put a soldier into combat, or no soldier had died in combat, I think something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That says a lot. Plus, you look back nostalgically at a time when the song was, I like Ike, because Ike is easy to like. Wouldn't we like that now?
Different time, Doris. How about JFK?
His is gone up and down over time, you know, since then. I mean, I think there was a period of time when there was such a great feeling for him right after the assassination. And then when LBJ was able to get past some of the legislation that Johnson was able to do that maybe JFK wouldn't have in civil rights.
Yeah.
JFK got credit for it. There's still an emotional attachment to him. You know, to some extent, for a while, the private lives that he was leading began to erode some of that feeling people had. But I think now it's become old news, and there's now a willingness to just look back on him. But he still only had 3 years. So as he himself worried, or as Bobby worried about JFK, there's just not enough time for him to truly be considered one of the great presidents. In fact, my husband had a conversation with Bobby once when Bobby was worrying about that, and to make Bobby feel better, Dick Goodwin, my husband, said, but don't worry, Julius Caesar only had 3 years. And then Bobby said, yeah, but it helps to have Shakespeare write about you.
Yeah, absolutely. I should point out your husband was a very well-connected operative for a number of years, right?
Correctly. He worked both for JFK and LBJ and Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah. Let's move on to Lyndon Johnson. You know, my sense is his stock maybe has fallen a little bit in recent years, given Vietnam and other issues. Am I right?
I hope not. No, in fact, I think when you look at historians' polls, he has come up slowly over time. And I think the reason is that we now look back on what was accomplished in the 1960s. Vietnam will always be a scar, without even a question. But when you think about Medicare and aid to education and immigration reform and three great civil rights bills, not only desegregating the South, but voting rights and fair housing, it all seemed to be taken for granted in the 60s. But now we look back at this dysfunctional Congress, and his ability to get people on both sides of the aisle to get together seems even more miraculous. So I think there's a greater recognition of his political genius now than there was before, even though Vietnam obviously will always be there.
Let's skip ahead to Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan. What do you see happening there? Yeah, I think we've lost Doris Kearns Goodwin again. We're going to call her back and get her on the line. We're going through a list of the more recent modern era presidents, trying to get her take on whether they've gone up or gone down. And our number here again, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or you can go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. And we have Doris back. You back there again, Doris? No, we'll get her back here in just a moment again. Again, our guest today, Doris Kearns Goodwin. She speaks March 1st as part of William Jewell College's Achievement Day at Kansas City's Westin Crown Center Hotel. You can visit our website, kcur.org, for more information there. Again, it's a rare chance to hear and see Doris Kearns Goodwin when she's in town on March 1st at Kansas City's Westin Crown Center Hotel. Again, she's the author of 2005's Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, a book highly acclaimed. And we're still having trouble getting her back on the line. We should get here in just a moment. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, a look at preserving some historic buildings in Kansas City and building a new one on the lawn of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. That and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. And again, we're waiting for Doris Kearns Goodwin.
I'm back.
You're back. Hey, how are you?
I'm glad you made it. I'm falling away. It's so weird.
It must be that Massachusetts phone system out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're just talking about Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan.
Well, I think Jimmy Carter, for a while, was able to make people feel better about his presidency because of his post-presidency, which has really been extraordinary.
Yes.
But I think now, looking back on that period when there was a sense of gloom about the country and when people weren't sure we were going to get through a difficult time and leadership didn't help us to do that, that may have hurt to some extent his reputation, along with some of the things he has said and done as post-president, which at first seemed all perfect and then got more complicated.
Absolutely. Ronald Reagan, my sense is he's arching ever upward.
No question. I mean, whether you one agrees with his policies or not, I think I realize now more than ever the enormous impact he had in creating an entire generation of young conservatives and making government the problem rather than the solution, so that that's become a reigning part of the ideology. I mean, during the period I'm writing about now, Teddy Roosevelt and the Progressive Era, they began to fight the fight about government has to have a role in reining in the private sector. And that fight seemed to have been won in the 30s and in the 60s. And then Reagan was able to turn it in another direction. And the fight over the deficit that we recently saw and the fight over the role of government really began with him. So there's no question that he is a much bigger figure, I think, than I realized at the time he was president.
Hmm. Is Abraham Lincoln the greatest president in your view?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, FDR comes way up there, too, in terms of meeting two crises, the Depression and the war.
Yeah.
But there's no human being that I've ever lived with during the time when I've spent with these presidents who matches the internal qualities of Abraham Lincoln. Just that willingness not to retaliate against people who had hurt him in the past, the willingness to bring in people who had all different points of view around him and let them argue with him, his kindness, his compassion, his incredible ability to write and to speak and to lead the country through our greatest crisis. I think there's no question that Lincoln still is on the top.
Now, in your book, Team of Rivals, you talked about literally former political rivals of the president, Abraham Lincoln bringing them into his inner circle and then those advisors really helping Lincoln succeed as president. To what extent do you think Barack Obama has tried to sort of copy that style with his bringing in Hillary Clinton and for that matter, Joe Biden? Is it the same kind of thing, or is it very different?
No, I think he really was imagining that he was reaching out in the same direction. I mean, he knew a lot about Lincoln. I had talked to him a couple times about Team of Rivals, and indeed, when he was asked at one point after he won the election, or after he won the nomination, would you really be willing to put into your inner circle one of your key rivals, even if his or her spouse were an occasional pain in the butt,
mm-hmm.
of course, referring to Hillary Clinton, he quoted directly from Lincoln saying, you know, the country's in peril. I need the strongest people by my side. Yes, I will do this. And then he put Hillary into that, and that's turned out incredibly well. I mean, I think everyone would agree she has been such a consummate professional. Their relationship has been strong. There's been no internal fighting that came out in the public, and they both probably made each other better. Joe Biden, similarly, he brought in Vilsack, who had been part of that earlier campaign. He tried to bring in the New Hampshire Republican senator, and that didn't work out. It's harder, again, to reach across party lines today, I think, because you're considered a traitor to your party if you join, as we saw what happened to John Huntsman. It made his whole presidential race much harder.
Yeah.
So that makes it more difficult to really do it. But I think he did it as much as he could have done it, possibly.
Yeah, Elaine has emailed us at uptodate@kcur.org. I want Doris Kearns Goodwin, she writes, to run for president. Her sense of history and how it applies to our future is outstanding. How about it, Doris?
Well, tell her thank you very, very much, but I think my time has passed if it ever were.
Okay, sorry about that, Elaine.
Reminded me, that's right, the other person that Obama kept in the cabinet was Gates.
That's right.
He had been in a big position under Republicans, so that's another answer to that question.
You know, it was reported once that you actually sort of had a crush on Abraham Lincoln.
I think that's probably true. You know, when you get up in the morning and you think about these people and you go to bed at night and you're still thinking about these people, they really do become a part of your life. When I was working on Franklin and Eleanor and they would have disagreements, I would be talking to both of them saying, Franklin, just stop it. You know she loves you. Or Eleanor, just forget about that affair you had so many years before.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
With Lincoln, you know, there was just something about being in his presence during this entire time. I was teased because I even thought there's a picture of him when he's a young man before the beard, and his hair is kind of wild, and he really looks sexy. And I happened to say that on Jon Stewart, and then I never could live that down. That's the impression one has of Abraham Lincoln.
I can only imagine what Jon Stewart would do with that, Doris. Yeah. But you said on this program the last time you were here that with Lincoln, he became a greater man than you had expected to find as you studied him more.
I think that's correct. I had always known that, I, like everybody else, I respected him as a statesman, and his personal story was so extraordinarily moving. What I hadn't realized, what a brilliant politician he was. You know, and again, in this day and age, that's so important to know that you can be a statesman, but at the same time, you can be a hard-nosed, tough, and really effective politician. And he loved politics. He understood people. He knew how to bring those people in his cabinet, not only into his circle, but he knew what to make them do so they didn't feel hurt if they weren't getting special attention. He'd spend time with one versus the other. And also, I think I hadn't understood his sense of humor until I really studied him.
And that made him so much more fun than I thought he'd be. I mean, just if we had any of that humor, we saw so little humor in these last debates. You know, sometimes it was a canned joke, but
yeah.
Lincoln would have outscored anybody in terms of humor had he been around today.
Our guest is the presidential scholar Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's the author of No Ordinary Time and Team of Rivals. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Joe here from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, you're on the air.
I just want to say that I got a chance to buy her book, Team of Rivals, and I was just fascinated that Lincoln had two members of his cabinet from Missouri, which was a slave state, and the two, I think, if I'm correct, one was Attorney General and one was Postmaster General.
Is that right, Doris?
The Attorney General, definitely, Mr. Bates, came from Missouri, and the Postmaster General was living at the time in Maryland but had roots there, too. So that is correct, and it makes sense because, you know, as a border state, Missouri allegiance to the country was really important at that period in time.
So yeah.
Being able to reach out to that to them was a good thing to do.
Joe, thank you. You know, when you're writing a book like Team of Rivals or No Ordinary Time, to what extent do you feel like you really get to know these people, you know, through your reading, through your research? And do they feel like they become something of a companion?
Oh, enough so that absolutely that when you finish, you feel terrible, like you've let somebody go.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant that those last few months of working on Lincoln, knowing he was going to die, became really difficult. The reason you can feel that way about especially figures in the past is because of diaries, because of letters. Those kind of intimate sources allow you, when you're really reading a diary entry or a letter that somebody wrote handwritten, to feel like you're back in that period of time. I think it'll be harder 200 years from now
if
people are recreating us to allow the writer or the reader to feel that same intimacy with their character, because we won't have that. We'll have email, but it's much more staccato, and who knows if it'll really be saved.
You know, I'm only imagining that as you're researching someone like Abraham Lincoln, you'd have just loved a chance to talk to him. What would you ask him today if you were having lunch with him in 20 minutes? What would you sit down and want to know?
I've often thought about that question, and I know I'm supposed to say, as an historian, I would ask him what he would have done differently about Reconstruction than Andrew Johnson did. But I know if I had that lunch with him, I would simply say to him, Mr. President, just tell me a story and let him go on with one of his funny stories after another, because it is said that when he told these stories, he came fully to life. He would laugh. He would pound his knee. He could mimic people. Yeah, that's right. And as my husband's reminding me sitting here, they weren't just stories. They were fables. They had a point, you know, they had a moral in the end. So I would just let him tell me five stories if I had time.
You know, there's one story that I think you've told before. It involves Lincoln and Ethan Allen, Great Britain, and an outhouse.
Correct. If I can say this on the air, I mean, I guess if Lincoln said it, we're safe in saying it. No, it's one of Lincoln's favorite stories. He said that Mr. Ethan Allen who was a Revolutionary War hero, went to England right after the war, and the English people were still smarting about having lost the Revolution, so they decided to embarrass him by putting a huge picture of General George Washington in the only outhouse where he would have to encounter it, and they figured he'd be very upset about the indignity of George Washington placed in an outhouse, but he comes out of the outhouse not upset at all, and they said to him, well, didn't you see George Washington there? Oh, yes, he said, the perfectly appropriate place for him. What else, George Washington?
Yeah.
And Lincoln had hundreds of those stories. There's another moment when somebody said to him, Lincoln, you're two-faced. And he looked right at the person. He said, if I had two faces, do you think I'd be wearing this face?
Well, you spent more than 10 years on this book. I'm just wondering, how difficult is it to spend that much time on a single book and probably wondering along the way if the book is going to work out or not?
Oh, it's very scary. I mean, and even knowing that it did work out, now that I've spent 6 years working on Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and The Muckraker Journalist, which is my new book, it's still that same fear comes back again. I mean, you just have to allow yourself to go chapter by chapter and know you're making progress. It does build up over time, these long books. But I was talking to Bob Massey, who wrote Catherine the Great the other day.
Yes.
And he, too, took 10 years in writing that. And we were sharing that experience that when you finish, like in my case, I have to move my books
of Lincoln into a different room so that there's room for the Teddy Roosevelt books. I had to move FDR away when there was time for Lincoln. And you feel like you're betraying the person who was there before.
Mm. Yeah. Is it easier to write these big books once you've done a couple of them, Doris, or is each one sort of a monster unto itself?
Probably monster unto himself still, although you do remember that you got through them before. And
yeah.
Even though you're late in delivering them, as I am time after time, you remember that you did finish it before. So it probably does help to have a few of them under your belt. But sometimes I wish I could just write a straight biography of somebody instead of, you know, Seward and Stanton and Chase and all
yeah.
those guys with Lincoln and now Teddy and Taft and these great muckraker journalists, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, William Allen White. They're all my characters again. If I wrote a straight one, maybe it could be done in 2 years instead of six or seven. But this is more fun, I think.
Do you write as you research, or do you do all your research and then write?
A lot of the research gets done first, probably the first, you know, couple years. But then you do start writing, and then each chapter, as you get to it, more research has to be done, of course. But if you wait, I remember reading Barbara Tuchman once that said, if you wait until all the research is done, you might paralyze yourself
yes.
in writing. So you have to start writing even when you have only a part of it done just to get that process beginning.
You know, you mentioned that your next book is on Teddy Roosevelt, and like your book on Lincoln, like your book on FDR, this is a topic that has been mined and mined and mined by so many authors over the years. Where are you headed with this book that might be different than what we've seen about Teddy Roosevelt in the past?
Well, the very reason why I have made it, a more of a multi-biography is because there have been so many good biographies simply straight of Teddy Roosevelt. So what I'm writing about, in part, is the broken friendship between Teddy and Taft. They were much greater friends than I had realized from the time they were in their 30s in Washington together when Taft was the head of when he was Solicitor General and Teddy was Civil Service Commissioner. They remained great friends while Taft went off to the Philippines. He then comes back in the cabinet. He's his closest advisor of Teddy's in the cabinet. And then Teddy runs his campaign in 1908 when Teddy decides not to run again, but then comes back and decides he wants the presidency in 1912. And they end up running against each other, devastating to both of them in a way, and destroying the Republican Party at that point. The Democrats win, and really ending the progressive wing of the Republican Party. So that story hasn't been fully told, but the other part of it is that what makes Roosevelt so successful as a progressive leader are these muckraker journalists, and they're all at one magazine called McClure's, run by this fabulous guy named Sam McClure, who's a manic depressive, truly, but brilliant, and they're great characters, as I say, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, William Allen White, and they create the climate of reform that helps Teddy, but then it turns against Taft, so...
Well,
it's really a fun story.
So clearly you're really interested in relationships between people. You're going after Roosevelt and Taft, much like Team of Rivals, in which you came up with this premise. How did you get the idea for Team of Rivals? That just hit you one day, or had you been working on it for a few years and mulling it through in your mind, or how did that come together?
You know, I did not have it at the start of that research. I instead was going to write about Abe and Mary, as I had written about Franklin and Eleanor, just thinking, okay, maybe I'll get confidence from having done this once before. But as I got into it, I realized that Mary couldn't carry the public side of the story, as Eleanor Roosevelt was certainly able to do. And more importantly, as I was reading the daily chronologies of what Lincoln did, I saw he was spending even more time with these characters in his cabinet than with Mary. So he was almost married to them more than to her. And then when I realized that they all had letters and diaries and that they'd all been his rivals, after maybe 2 years into the research, I thought, oh, that's the story I want to tell.
Yeah.
So it did emerge from the panic of realizing that I didn't think, for me, the Abe and Mary story would work, because I wanted to have the public side of the Civil War, not simply the private relationship between the two.
You know, I've always wanted to ask this. When you appear on a program like Meet the Press on Sunday mornings, to what extent do you know ahead of time what the show's host, in this case now David Gregory, is going to ask? Do you talk about it ahead of time, or is it just completely...
You know the general topics that are going to be in the segment, but it means you really do have to prepare. So it gets scary sometimes, to be honest, because I have to wrench myself away from whatever I'm working on, like 1900,
yeah.
and come back into the present reading the papers much more carefully. But it's a good thing, because whenever you do something, especially like Meet the Press, which I think is my favorite program to be on, you feel like you're then caught up. Like I could even talk to you today.
about Romney and Gingrich in a way I might not have been able to 3 weeks ago, because I would have said, "Ooh, I'm back in 1900. I don't know who these guys are."
Hey, do you get paid for being on the show?
No. Huh. At one point during the 1990s, during the impeachment scandal and Clinton, they did hire various people to be on exclusive, and I was on NBC for a period of time. But now I'm not, so I can just go on channels whenever I want, but you don't get paid for it.
Well, we're all going to look forward to your new book, Doris, and by all means, come back and talk to us about Teddy Roosevelt.
Hopefully a year from now, I will be it'll be there.
Well, good luck, and it's been a pleasure, Doris. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Bye-bye. That's Doris Kearns Goodwin. She'll be guest speaker at William Jewell College's Achievement Day on March 1st at Kansas City's Weston Crown Center Hotel. Visit our website at kcur.org for more information. Don't forget to follow KCUR's Facebook page and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, a look at preserving some historic buildings in Kansas City and the building of a new one on the lawn of the Nelson Atkins. That and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Kathleen Pointer, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of a Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.